Hey, y'all, here's how to support the show. First of all, check out my book, Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan. It's at foolserrand.us. Sign up for the podcast feeds at scotthorton.org and check out scotthorton.org/donate. Anybody who donates $20 gets to the front of the list to get the audio book, and it's really coming soon. I'm done. My audio mastering dude has it now, and it's going to be soon. So $20 gets you to the front of the list for that. A donation of $50 to scotthorton.org/donate gets you a signed copy of the book. $100 gets you a QR code, commodity disc. No face value. You scan it with your phone, and it tells you the instant spot price in real time. It's the most brilliant invention ever. And for a donation of $200 or more to the Scott Horton Show, you get a lifetime subscription to Listen and Think Libertarian audiobooks at listenandthink.com. And they're the ones putting out my book, my audiobook too. And I take all kinds of cryptocurrencies. If you want to donate them, I'll accept them. All that's at scotthorton.org/donate. Shop amazon.com by way of my link. Leave me good reviews on iTunes, Stitcher, and Amazon if you read the book. And, invite me to give a speech to your group.
War is the improvement of investment climates by other means, Clausewitz, for dummies.
The Scott Horton Show.
Taking out Saddam Hussein turned out to be a pretty good deal.
They hate our freedoms.
We're dealing with Hitler Revisited.
We couldn't wait for that Cold War to be over, could we? So we can go and play with our toys in the sand. Go and play with our toys in the sand.
No nation could preserve its freedom in the midst of continual warfare.
Today, I authorize the armed forces of the United States to begin military action in Libya. That action has now begun.
When the president does it, that means that it is not illegal.
I cannot be silent in the face of the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government.
All right, you guys, introducing Reese Ehrlich, the foreign correspondent. His website is reeseehrlich.com, and we run his syndicated column at antiwar.com. His latest book is Inside Syria, and his book, Iran Agenda, The Iran Agenda, the updated version, is coming out in the fall or late summer here. Welcome back to the show, Reese. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much.
Very happy to have you on. And yeah, by foreign correspondent, we really mean that. Reese has traveled all around the world and has been to all these places, including very recently, covering Iraq War III, the very end of Iraq War III, and all this kind of stuff. So, and Iraq War III, of course, includes Eastern Syria as well, the war against the Islamic State there. All right, so just real quick, in northeastern Syria, this whole time since 2011, since the so-called revolution broke out, however you want to characterize it, the Syrian Kurds, they've not fought against the state army, the government in Damascus there, but they have sort of gained increased autonomy or even independence there. And they were the Syrian Kurdish forces, the SDF, the YPG, and you can explain those initials on your elaboration if you want to. They were really the primary force backed and armed by the United States in the war against in the Americans' part of the war against the Islamic State in the capital of Raqqa and in East Syria there. But these same Kurdish forces are the avowed enemies of the Turkish state, our NATO ally, and the Turkish state is certainly their avowed enemies. And they have now, well, they already, you know, had a presence inside Syria, but they are now, there's a whole new invasion, basically, of Syrian Kurdistan and attacks on these Syrian forces. So the Syrian Kurdish forces. So I guess the first most important question is, do you think that there's a danger that the Turks and the Americans are going to end up trading fire here? Or what is the status of America's alliance with these Kurds? Is it now time to stab them in the back and leave them high and dry and let the Turks massacre them, or what?
Well, I don't think either the Turks or the U.S. want to get into a shooting war. But the danger in this situation is that things can get out of control. And the Turks have now sent in troops to an area called Afrin, as which you've described there in northeastern Syria. And the U.S. has troops nearby The Russian Air Force controls the airspace there. So in any kind of war situation, things can get out of hand regardless of what people may intend. As to what the U.S. intention is, if I was a Syrian Kurd, I'd be real worried right now, because the U.S. had backed them in their efforts to get rid of the Islamic State. And Trump and Tillerson announced that the U.S. would stay in northern Syria and would basically permanently and would continue to arm the SDF or the Syrian Democratic Forces. But now, when push comes to shove, it's a hands-off, because as the Turks move into that area of Afrin, the U.S. has not even strongly denounced it, let alone threatened to send troops. So that's the immediate situation, and we can go into the background to try and explain all this stuff if you like.
Yeah, let's do that. But just on this most important point, I mean, at the end of the day, America's the world empire and all that. So all the Syrian stuff is important, but the confusion and the contradiction in America's relationship with Turkey at this point, I guess is the most important thing. And you have some people saying, well, maybe we should kick Turkey out of NATO or suspend them or this and that. They're out of control. But America's really gone along with a lot of Turkey's policy in supporting the al-Nusra Front and even turning a blind eye to their support for the Islamic State for quite a few years there before it really declared itself a state, right?
Yeah, it sure did. And the U.S. basically, when it comes to choosing between the Kurds and Turkey, Turkey has a key military base in Incirlik that the U.S. uses throughout the region and most recently in fighting the Islamic State. And Turkey is a major NATO force in the area. It's got a huge population. And I think while there's a debate that's going on in Washington, the U.S., I think, ultimately is not going to side with the Kurds against Turkey. There's just too much from an imperial standpoint. The U.S. has too much to gain from the Turks.
Yeah, I remember Phil Giraldi joking a few years ago that, I don't know, man, at the end of the day, the Kurds got oil. What do the Turks have? There's never a worse position to be in than a best friend and ally of the United States of America, right? You never know when the knife is coming.
You never know when you get stabbed in the back.
And that goes for both sides, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Hey, listen. All right. So, well, what's really Turkey's problem here? Because, I know that they have their historical problems with the YPG, which I guess is basically the Syrian branch of the PKK, who are the leftist sort of separatists inside Turkey. And yet, I mean, what harm do they really pose to the Turkish state? The Turkish state is not at war against the Kurdish population, not any full-scale war like it was in the 1990s or anything against the Kurdish population in Turkey. They have pretty much a ceasefire reigning there, and it's not like these Syrian Kurds are going to invade Turkey or, you know.
Sorry, Scott, I got to interrupt you here, but no, that's not true. For the last roughly year and a half, the Turkish government has been waging a very fierce war against the Kurds in Turkey.
That's still going on? I thought that was just kind of in the aftermath of that stolen election, but.
No, it's still going on. You don't hear a lot about it in the Western press, but
sure don't.
The Turkish.
So in other words, it really is back like the 1990s, the Bill Clinton years, where they were just slaughtering people by the thousands.
Yeah, it's maybe not quite as bad as then, but it's quite severe. And there's a guerrilla war going on by the PKK. There's towns being occupied by the Turkish army. It is a war against the Turkish people. It's not just against the leftist.
Okay, but my question still stands, even though my premise was wrong, which is, but what difference does it make about the independent Rojava in Syrian Kurdistan? Because they're not trying to erase that border and foment revolution inside Turkey and all that. They're taking care. They have their own business, their own concerns. They're taking care of there, right or not?
Yeah, this is where a little bit of background helps. So the PKK, or the Kurdistan Workers Party, was formed back in the late 1980s. It was at the time, called for independence for all the Kurds living in all four countries where they're located, Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Turkey. But roughly 20 years ago, after the arrest of Öcalan, their leader, they made a very significant change, which is ignored by pretty much all the governments and the mass media here. They reject independence and call for autonomy within the countries that they live. And that's a critical difference because, and that's been going, that's 20 years they've had that position, and that's what they carry out. So whether it be in Turkey or in Syria, the PKK affiliated groups want to call for autonomy. Now, specifically in Syria, I think your statement is correct, which is they don't really pose any military threat to Turkey as long as the Turks are not trying to wipe them out. They were the first, one of the first groups to take up armed struggle in Syria at the time that Assad was repressing people. They have promoted women in an unprecedented way. They actually even defend gay rights, which is something in the Middle East that you never hear about. And they've got plenty of authoritarian tendencies. I'm not a big booster of the PKK, but compared to a lot of the other groups in the area, they look a whole lot better. And the Kurds do have a legitimate case for autonomy and greater democracy within the Syrian state. And it's true they didn't clash with there were a few clashes with the Assad government, but basically both sides agreed to not attack each other for their own separate reasons. Now that the Islamic State has been defeated and Assad is reasserting control through much of the rest of Syria, those contradictions are coming to a head. So Syria and the Russians are allied with Syria in hopes that they're going to wipe out the YPG and the SDF, that is the Syrian Kurds. The U.S., supposedly on the side of the Kurds, is backing off at the moment.
Well, you know, I want to see footage of that, Reese. American Marines withdrawing east toward the Iraqi border and telling the SDF, well, you guys can keep some trucks. Good luck. Just leaving them high and dry there.
Yeah, that might very well be the case. The U.S., it was just about a few days ago that the U.S. announced that they were going to train 30,000 Syrian Kurds and their allies as border guards or border police or border army along the Turkish-Syrian border. Mm-hmm. And now, a week later, when the Turks attack, the U.S. is backing off. And, I mean, this is what an empire in decline looks like. You announce one policy, and then a week later, it flips and goes somewhere else. And who knows, a week from now, they'll go back again. The U.S. is in a, by sending its troops illegally, by the way, into Syria, they've created another permanent war in the Middle East, along with Iraq and Afghanistan, yeah. Not to mention Libya and some of the other places. And every time we send troops, it seems like it's going to, the initial reaction in the U.S. is, oh, boy, we're going to really solve the problem now. And then 6 months, 6 years, 10 years later, whoops, what kind of a mess did we make back then?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what. I mean, and this one is since 2011. I mean, and I don't know if I've played this clip for you before. Here, let me go ahead and cue this up because I'd like to have you comment on this. And if we've already gone through this exercise one time on an old episode, Reese, I think that it still bears repeating anyway, and the people probably won't mind too much. So this is Hillary Clinton. It's the very end of February 2012, the beginning of her last year in office there. And she is, of course, a proponent of further support for the war against Assad and the backing of these so-called revolutionaries and the uprising there in Syria. And yet she's in this clip, she's being put on the defensive by the CBS News reporter who's asking her, why aren't we doing more? And she's having to defend Obama's policy of authorizing $1 billion a year of covert support for these guys, but not a full-scale overthrow and this kind of thing. So here's how she justifies the administration's unwillingness to go all the way against Assad the way that they did against Gaddafi.
We know al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting al-Qaeda in Syria? Hamas is now supporting the opposition. Are we supporting Hamas in Syria?
And so this has been from the very beginning for those of us, I know you know, and you wrote the whole book about it, but you know, the reports came out about Prince Bandar bin Sultan was starting to support and send jihadists to go and fight in Syria beginning in late spring, early summer 2011. These reports were coming out. My friend Eric Margulies, also foreign correspondent is his title, He went to France and talked to all his buddies in the diplomatic corps and military and civilian intelligence over there and whatever. They said, oh yeah, French special forces are on the ground helping to organize the revolution right now. We knew this in the summer of 2011, that in the scheme of things, you talk about the policy flipping back and forth one thing or the other. In the scheme of things, we had America taking Al-Qaeda's side. Just as Hillary Clinton said, supporting the FSA is supporting Al-Qaeda in effect, isn't it? That's her own framing of the subject. And of course, she was right. And then, of course, she continued to pressure Obama to double down on it anyway.
Well, there's no question that Hillary Clinton was a hawk on not only in Syria, but throughout the Middle East and general foreign policy, which is one of the reasons while I voted for her, I was very wary of what would happen had she come to power. And of course, the fact that Trump is in power, it's even 10 times worse. Because,
but I mean, this really is the ultimate bait and switch. And that's what Gareth Porter says. Look, we have this war against Al-Qaeda, supposedly. And then we go and we attack all these countries that not only did these state governments not back Al-Qaeda, nor did they threaten the United States or threaten to use Al-Qaeda against the United States or anything like that, but actually by attacking Saddam Hussein, Muammar Gaddafi, Bashar al-Assad in Iraq, Libya, Syria, we turn these countries into failed states. Oh, the Islamic Courts Union in Somalia and the chaos in Yemen too. We turn them into failed states. We create the growth of these Al-Qaeda jihadist movements, sometimes quite deliberately, like in Libya and Syria, to help them in their fight against these governments that never would back them or pick a fight with us in any circumstances.
Well, I think I would shade that argument just a bit. When the Arab Spring demonstrations took place throughout the region, including Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, as well as Libya and Egypt and Tunisia and Syria, they were genuine mass movements, not controlled by Al-Qaeda, by the U.S. or anybody else, or Israel. And the local dictators were hated, including Assad. And that popular movement included both what we call civil society activists and conservative political Islamists, people like the Muslim Brotherhood. But had Assad not cracked down on the Syrian uprising, I think there could have been a reasonable new government with elections, with a new constitution, something along the lines of what happened in Tunisia. But two things happened. The Assad government cracked down very, very hard, and people were very angry and turned to armed struggle. And at the same time, all the outside powers you mentioned got very active in trying to promote their own interests, their own armed groups. And Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Turkey all tried to back proxy forces. And of course, the U.S. was very much involved in there. Within a year of the uprising, its character had changed decisively. And the U.S., I don't think, sets out to create failed states, but it would rather see a failed state than a government that is unfriendly to the U.S. And so that's the net result of the policy in Libya. And could potentially be the case in Syria. That's still up for grabs. It's certainly the case in Afghanistan, where the opposition forces to the U.S. are quite strong. They attacked the Intercontinental Hotel just over the last couple of days, and Trump has said that we're going to keep troops there permanently. And frankly, an empire in decline can't continue to support all of these multiple military efforts all around the world. And in the region, and I think Trump is going to end up paying the piper on that in the not-too-distant future.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I mean, for all of her dastardliness, Hillary Clinton, I think, could at least understand that, you know, sometimes we fight for the Shiite side and sometimes we fight for the Sunni side and this kind of thing.
Yeah,
I don't know if she could justify it, but she could. If you explained it to her, she would go, okay, yeah, that makes sense or something, right? But Donald Trump and his guys, they don't even seem to know what planet they're on or who is what. I mean, Trump, you probably noticed when he congratulated the president of Lebanon for defeating those evil terrorists, ISIS and Hezbollah, when it was actually Hezbollah that defeated ISIS in Lebanon and had driven them out. And he didn't know what the hell he was talking about.
Yeah, no, Trump is just a real piece of work. I mean, the guy is the most unqualified president we've had in a long time. And that, and he's got some stiff competition when you look at George Bush and some of these other guys.
And Obama, for that matter.
Well, Obama was smart. I mean, I didn't agree with his policies. In fact, I was very critical of his policies.
But yes, he can read books and stuff. I get
but
that.
Yeah, he knew the area. He knew he could find Iraq on a map. I'm not entirely clear Trump could do that. But, you know, once you get a click below Trump to his advisors, they're smart people. They're evil, but they're smart, and they're playing the game, the imperial game, in the region, in hopes that the U.S. is going to emerge controlling the oil fields, establishing the military bases, and having governments favorable to the U.S. And if that's not an option, then you just make it a failed state and the people suffer.
All right, hang on just one second. Hey, guys, I got a new sponsor, Zencash, a new digital currency, but it's got the great privacy protections built in. And it's a messaging service, and you can send documents and all kinds of things. It's really great. So check that out at zencash.io. Also, buy the book The War State by my friend Mike Swanson. It's a great history of the rise of the military-industrial complex after World War II. You'll really enjoy it. And check out his great investment advice at wallstreetwindow.com. And when you follow his advice, you'll want to get at least some medals. And you do that from Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc., and they've been around for 40-something years. It's a great company. They charge a very low premium to get you platinum, palladium, silver, and gold, and whatever you need there. And when you buy in Bitcoin, there's no charge. That's at rrbi.co, rrbi.co for your precious metals. And get your anti-government propaganda from libertystickers.com. If you want a brand new website for 2018, expanddesigns.com/Scott. We'll save you $500. Mm-hmm. The dynamics were a little bit different a year ago when Trump bombed Damascus, because you have the whole new president, the partisanship and whatever had flipped, and so it was a little more muddy water. But in 2013, there was only the Israel lobby in America, the neoconservatives and their think tanks and acolytes and the Weekly Standard who wanted to attack Assad over the fake sarin attack there in Ghouta, the Turkish al-Qaeda false flag there. And in fact, I had a speculation, it's not ironclad or whatever, but I had a little theory at the time that, in fact, there was a report that Obama had asked the Israel lobby for help on pressuring people into Syria, and I thought that at that point, maybe he had already decided not to do it, and he just wanted to encourage them to go out on a limb and really kind of show that no one else in all of American so-called civil society on either coast wants to attack the government in Syria. Only the neoconservatives and the Likudniks and their pressure groups inside this country. The military was against it, right? The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Dempsey, said, well, I don't know why we have to do this now. And it was it. That was it, right?
No, that was a real nadir in U.S. policy in the Middle East, because the American people were fed up with the war in Iraq, and as were people around the world. And when the U.S. threatened to bomb Syria because of the so-called chemical weapons attack, the people in the United States overwhelmingly opposed it. And that's why Obama ended up backing down on that case. It wasn't because he was weak-kneed. It's because people were fed up with American troops dying in the Middle East and continued military occupation. Mm-hmm. Trump, to some extent, has been able to reverse that. But I think the key factor is going to be when American troops start dying. We saw that happen in Niger when 4 troops were killed. We saw it with 1 special ops person killed in Syria. It's not going to take much to anger American public opinion once again.
Mm-hmm. All right, so what is the status of the Islamic State and al-Qaeda? I guess first one, then the other.
Sure.
It's no longer a state, I know that.
Yeah, that's nor is it Islamic. The Islamic State obviously has faced some very serious setbacks. They don't control any significant land area anymore. They've been driven out of Raqqa and the parts of Syria that they controlled. And as we mentioned, the Syrian Democratic Forces control a significant part of that area. They have basically been defeated in Iraq, and they are still carrying out terrorist attacks, for example, in Baghdad and a few places, and groups that have claimed affiliation with them in other parts of the world, for example, in the Philippines, have carried out horrific attacks on civilians. But and I guess in Afghanistan, similarly, they have some presence, but they are significantly weakened. They're not able to attract the international financing and recruitment that they had before, and other groups are taking over in their stead, either somewhat moderate or other extremist groups. But the Islamic State is still there, is still a danger, but it's far weaker than it was even a year ago. Al-Qaeda has tried to fill the gap. They've tried to, they were fiercely in opposition to each other. They came out of the same group. They were a split, and they were fighting each other in Syria, for example, and in other places. Al-Qaeda never declared itself an Islamic State. That was one of the big differences they had. But they were operating in as a national group, for example, in Syria and other places, in other countries, in Jordan and so on. So Al-Qaeda is weakened as well. In Syria, they controlled much greater areas, for example, in southern Syria and in parts of the eastern part of the country. And they've pretty much been constrained now to the Idlib province, which is north of Aleppo. So they also are operating, of course, in places like Yemen and are far from defeated. But in general, they're weaker than they were a year ago as well.
All right, so now, boy, old Rex Tillerson, I mean, I guess you must have read or seen this speech that he gave where he is explaining about how, simple as that, we're turning on a dime, and the new mission now is somehow to limit the presence and the power and influence of Iran inside Syria, when, of course, their power and influence has only grown as a result of this attempt to limit their power and influence in Syria, just like in everywhere else.
If you could take any kind of objective look at what's going on in Syria, the Assad, Russian, Iranian side has won, or at least made significantly more victories than the U.S., Turkish, Saudi side.
And we've really made the Syrian state more dependent on Russia and Iran. Thanks, Quds Force, for your help. He must be saying to them every day, right?
Yeah, that not only in Syria, but in Iraq as well.
Nasrallah, too.
Yeah, the Iranian government openly credits Iran, not the United States, for having helped defeat the Islamic State. So again, the more troops we send, the more people we kill, the angrier people get, and the declared enemies of the U.S. Become stronger.
So now, I don't know. Let's go back to that bigger picture thing about the failing and flailing empire, as you describe it, because I'm really interested in that kind of big picture stuff, too. I wonder, not to get all too conspiratorial or whatever, but just, I'm a libertarian, so way I look at it, all bureaucracies in monopoly government power fail upwards until they get to ultimate failure, right? War is the health of the state unless it loses and gets conquered, but otherwise it helps to centralize, corruption. And the U.S. military budget is the greatest honeypot in the history of the world. As William S. Lind once called it, I think, $1 trillion a year. Up for grabs, and all of the power and perks of being a general or being an admiral and having a fleet and having a base and all of these things. And so, everything that they do, they sure screw up, and yet they stay busy. And isn't that really kind of the point? Sorry, one more thing. There is a couple of great quotes. I won't read them to you or anything, but a couple of great quotes along the lines from a few years ago. Well, now that we're drawn down from Iraq and Afghanistan, we're trying to find ways to stay globally engaged. So we're looking to Africa and see what we can do to expand there. Because it's just a jobs program, right? It's just another government program, only it's $1 trillion a year and a lot of violence.
Well, for sure, that's a side effect. When you have $1 trillion as basically a slush fund to use whatever way you want, some of it goes to buy advanced weapons, and you end up sitting on the board of that Once you retire as a general or admiral, you end up sitting on the board of that arms manufacturer, and you know your personal wealth and well-being is guaranteed. But I think the U.S. empire is based on not just the military expansion, but frankly on the economics of control of vital resources, particularly oil. And in order to control the oil, you need to have a friendly government in power, which means geopolitics, and you need military bases or control of the sea lanes in order to make sure that those vital resources are under the control of the U.S. and not only under control of the U.S., but denied to your enemies, whether they be Russia, China, Iran, or whoever. And so it's an entire system all wrapped up, of which the military is a key component. And then of course the propaganda that goes out is that we're not an imperialist power like those other evil people. I guess it would be the Russians and the Chinese and the Iranians. We're the good guys, and the other side is the ones who promote dictatorship and authoritarian governments and so on and so forth. But you know, when you look at the actual governments that the U.S. is allied with, particularly in the Middle East, you see, you know, one dictatorial monarchy or dictatorial power after another. They're the emerging democracy, whereas all the people that we're fighting are horrible dictatorships. So you get on all those levels, economics, politics, military, media and propaganda, they all are, you know, united to as part of one system. And the problem is that, you know, you compare this now to the 50s, 60s, 70s, particularly before the end of the Vietnam War, and the U.S. was actually able to impose its will on countries around the world. And these days it's having more and more problems, and fewer folks are going for it.
Right. Well, and, you know, so back to the question of the Israel lobby there, it does seem like there's honest belief sometimes, maybe not always, but let's be charitable, that, hey, Israel's interests and America's interests are one and the same thing all the time, obviously. And yet, obviously, that's not true. Certainly, it's not to me. It seems like, and you know me, I want to just, you know, abolish the whole Pentagon and forget the whole thing. But assuming even the premise of American dominance and primacy in the region, what would be smart, at least even in the short term, would be to at least sit back and watch and laugh as Iran and Hezbollah and the Syrian army and the Shiite Iraqi government that we installed in power there destroy ISIS and Al-Qaeda. Never mind backing them or anything like that, but why would we be opposed to that? And the only reason we're opposed to that is because of the power of the Likud party in Washington, D.C.
Well, that's a factor for sure. I don't think Likud or the Israelis control U.S. policy, but they certainly are a powerful influence force. And, you know, to go along with what you were saying, what if the U.S. actually helped the Israelis and Palestinians create a viable two-state solution where the Palestinians had their own control of their own area in the West Bank and Gaza? It would pull the rug out from under all the arguments of Al-Qaeda, the Islamic State, the Iranians, and everybody else, that somehow they're the defenders of the Palestinian people. If the Palestinians themselves reached a reasonable solution that was popular among the Palestinians, it would do more to stop the wars of the Middle East than all of the U.S. troops combined. But of course, the U.S. isn't interested, it's particularly not interested under Trump. It wasn't interested in doing that even before him, but Trump has made it really obvious with this move to establish a U.S. embassy in Jerusalem, which is a slap in the face of the Palestinians. And it would be better off, the people of Israel would be better off living in peace with the Palestinians and not under a constant fear of attack and so on. And Israel could, you know, be an economic partner, et cetera, et cetera. But the folks running Israel are not interested in that. They've made that very clear. And that just leads to greater and greater instability for the people of Israel as well as the Palestinians.
All right. Now, in Gareth Porter's book, Manufactured Crisis, about Iran's nuclear program, he talks about how Yitzhak Rabin, when he was, you know, really wanted to give up at least a big part of the West Bank to stop occupying it, not give it up, that it was his to give up, but anyway, you know what I mean, to allow the creation of a Palestinian state on the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip, that that was, you know, the revolution 79 made no difference. The Israelis and the Iranians still got along fine. Reagan used the Israelis to do the Iran-Contra missile hostage, you know, Contra death squad scam and all that. They got along fine. It wasn't till Rabin needed Iran as a scapegoat when he was trying to do the right thing and create a Palestinian state and say, oh, no, you know, the real problem is Iran, everybody, as a political thing. But then one of Netanyahu's fans shot and killed Rabin. And so then, according to Porter, all of the later prime ministers used Iran in the same way to demonize them and distract from Palestine, but not doing the right thing and giving up and allowing there to be a Palestinian state, giving up that territory and allowing there to be a Palestinian state there, but instead to distract from the fact that they would always deny independence to the Palestinians. And whenever anybody says anything about the Palestinians, Netanyahu especially says, what about Iran? What about Iran? What about Iran? But I know that you also are a real expert on this going way back, so I wonder what you make of that.
Sure. Well, I actually reported from Israel in the 80s when, unbeknownst to most Americans, Israel backed Iran in the Iran-Iraq War. When Iraq attacked Iran in 1980 and the war went on for 8 years, I repeat, Israel backed Iran. Why? Because they saw Saddam Hussein as the bigger enemy. He was arming various Palestinian groups. Iran and Israel had close relations under the Shah, and Iran's whole military was U.S. equipment, and the Israelis provided the Iranians with spare parts and planes and missiles, etc., to fight against Iraq. So, that changed, of course, when the Iran-Iraq war is over, and as you described with Rabin. Israel has a history of trying to blame Palestinian unrest on outside powers. So it was Jordan, and then Lebanon, and then Iraq, and now Iran. Instead of dealing directly with the Palestinians and resolving their problems, they say, if we only get rid of this outside power, well, then we Israelis will be safe and secure. And of course, it hasn't proven true in the last 60 years and isn't going to be true in the future.
And what an important point. I mean, just think about that. Where Iran is no threat to Israel whatsoever. What do? They sell some missiles to Hezbollah. Well, even for whatever that amounts to, that could be negotiated. And Hezbollah clearly is no offensive threat to try to invade and conquer northern Israel or anything like that. They simply have a defensive force there. So what other threat is there? They're going to sail their giant navy through the Red Sea and attack Israel that way or something? What are we even talking about?
Yeah. And the Iranian government, contrary to what the Israeli leaders say, has made it clear that they would accept a two-state solution if the Palestinians accept it. So it's really the Israelis who are blocking any kind of peace in the area. I mean, Iran, to be fair, Iran's leaders are extremists who use Islam as their excuse, both to oppress their own people and to extend influence in the region. But Iran is not anything close to, nor is it going to be, the kind of military power that Israel is. It's the number one military power in the region, is going to be for some time. And Israel could, particularly in alliance with the U.S., could wipe out Iran fairly quickly. In terms of a bomb, I don't mean wipe them out and defeat them militarily, but they could cause a lot of damage. And the Iranian government knows that. So while they have a lot of rhetoric against Israel, in practice, they're very cautious about what they're doing and what arms are involved, et cetera, et cetera. And I think you're right. Hezbollah has not attacked Israel despite all of the provocations that have gone on, and I don't think they are going to go on the offensive against Israel. They would respond if Israel attacks them, which unfortunately may be in the there's a lot of talk in Israel about renewing the war in Lebanon, going back against Hezbollah again. I hope that doesn't happen.
Yeah. Okay, so one more thing here before I let you go, and I'm sorry for keeping you over, but there's an important piece in The Intercept today about how the Israelis are expanding their so-called safe zone from the Golan Heights, which they seized in, I forget, 67 or 73, you tell me. But it's Syrian territory occupied by Israel. 67. And that they're expanding down from there into you know, Syria proper, I guess, as you'd call it.
Yeah, no, it's very dangerous. Israel seized the Golan in 67. There was some additional fighting in the 73 war. And yes, Israel has taken advantage of the instability in Syria and the fact that the Golan area on the Syrian side was controlled by various groups, not the Syrian government. They may well try to extend that control beyond the what had been settled or had been settled by the war in 73. So we'll have to keep a very close eye on that. And, you know, Israel was meddling in its own way, supporting different rebel groups in Syria in hopes that they could defeat Assad and have a group, if not friendly to Israel, at least not antagonistic to Israel. So that's an ongoing fear, a danger.
I mean, I'm sorry, but are they really just only thinking 2 weeks ahead, or what do they think they're going to do? They're going to end up in a war with the Syrian army and then maybe with Iran and whoever else is going to back them there. If just colonizing, they're going to, you know, how much further are they going to expand and take this territory? And then are they going to move civilians into it? Is that their plan?
We'll have to wait and see. I mean, they tried it in Lebanon. You remember they occupied southern Lebanon on the grounds that it was a buffer zone against attack. Mm-hmm. They were forced out by Hezbollah. That was Hezbollah's great victory. They defeated Israel in two different wars. At the moment, I think the Israelis want to take advantage of the weakness of Assad. But if he's able to consolidate his control and continues to get backing for Russia and Iran, then that becomes, if Israel does try to formally seize new territory, that's a very, very dangerous move.
Mm-hmm. I got to tell you, this whole clean break plan, never mind how criminal it is, it seems really stupid to me. You know, stupid like a fox, as Homer Simpson might say. But, you know,
well,
I don't know.
Have me back on the show and we can talk some more about it.
All right. Thanks very much, Reese. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Scott.
All right, you guys, that's Reese Ehrlich, foreign correspondent. We run him at antiwar.com, and his latest book is Inside Syria. And you know me, I'm at scotthorton.org. That's where you find all the interviews, 4,500-something interviews going back 2003. FoolsErrand.us for my book, Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan. The Libertarian Institute at libertarianinstitute.org. And follow me on Twitter, @ScottHortonShow. Thanks.